Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents In the Eye of the Wild by Nastasia Martin. Translated from the French by Sophie R. Lewis. Narrated by Cassandra Campbell. For I have been ere now a boy and a girl, a bush and a bird, and a dumb fish in the sea. Empedocles, On Nature, Fragment 117. Autumn. The bear left some hours ago now, and I am waiting for the mist to lift. The steppe is red, my hands are red, face swollen and gashed, unrecognizable. As in the time of myths, obscurity reigns. I am this blurred figure, features subsumed beneath the open gulfs in my face, slicked over with internal tissue, fluid, and blood. It is a birth, for it is manifestly not a death. Around me, wads of brown hair stiffened by dried blood litter the ground, proof of the recent combat. For 8 hours, perhaps more, I've been hoping a Russian army helicopter will break through the fog to come and find me. I made a tourniquet for my leg with my rucksack strap when the bear took off, and Nikolai helped bandage my face when he reached me. He emptied our precious supply of spirit over my head, and it ran down my cheeks along with the tears and blood. Then he left me. He took my little fieldwork Alcatel to call the emergency services from the spur of an outcrop, thinking, inevitably, of the patchy network, the ancient phone, the far-off cell towers, praying they would all hold up. Because all around rise the volcanoes that only a few moments earlier feted our freedom, but now mark out our prison. I am cold. I feel for my sleeping bag, wrap myself in it as best I can. My thoughts go out to the bear, then back to myself, building connections, analyzing and dissecting, fashioning a survivor's castles in the air. Inside, my mind must look like a wild proliferation of synapses, sending and receiving data more rapidly than ever. That is the pace of it. Dazzling, lightning fast, unchecked and ungovernable. The pace of dreaming. Yet nothing has ever been more real or more immediate. The sounds I hear are enhanced. I hear like an animal. I am that wild animal. I wonder for a moment whether the bear will come back to finish me off, or to be killed by me, or indeed for us to both die in a final embrace. But already I sense, that this will not happen. He is far away now. He is stumbling through the high steppe, blood dripping down his pelt. As he grows farther away and I look deeper into myself, we each regain our self-possession. He without me, I without him. How to survive despite what I have lost in the other's body? How to live with what has been left behind there? I hear it long before it arrives. To Nikolai and Lana, who rejoined me a moment ago, it's inaudible. It's coming, I say. No, nothing there, they reply. Just us in the vast space with the mist that rises and falls. Yet a few minutes later, an orange metal monster, a refugee from the Soviet era, comes to pluck us from this place. It's night in Klutschi, the solid depths of the night. Klutschi, Key Village, the training center, the Russian army's secret base in the Kamchatka region. I am not meant to know that it's at this poor strip of earth that Moscow is firing weekly missiles in order to measure their range and be ready to hit the Bering Strait's American coastline in the event of war. I am also not meant to know that all the indigenous peoples in the area, the Ivens, Koryaks, and Itelmens, what's left of them, are recruited here because without reindeer and without forest, Absurdity is now the norm, and it has come down to fighting on behalf of their tormentors. Except I do know it, and have known it from the start. I know it because it's my profession to know these things. The Ivens, whose lives in the forest I've been sharing for several months, have told me about the bombs that explode near their barracks in the evenings. They laughed at my questions, studied my face, often called me a spy, lightly, teasingly, ironically. They tried me out in every possible role, but they never held anything back. The village, the drinking, the fights, the forest that is retreating, and with it their native tongue forgotten little by little, the lack of work, the homeland, their savior, which offers them the base at Clutchy in return. The irony of fate. The clinic is in this key village. This is where we land, behind the barbed wire and fences, behind the watchtowers, plumb into the lion's den. I, who used to enjoy a private giggle at knowing all these top-secret things about this top-secret place, now find myself actually inside the medical facility for the soldiers and wounded of the almost war that quietly goes on here. An old lady stitches up my wounds. I watch her handle the needle and thread with infinite care. I have passed through the pain stage. I feel nothing now, but I'm still awake. I don't miss a stitch. I am lucid beyond my human senses, detached from my body while still within it. S'il vous êtes courageux, everything will be fine. Her voice, her hands, that's all. I see my long blonde and red hair fall in clumps at my feet as she cuts it off so she can sew up the slashes on my head, which by some miracle has not been crushed. I struggle to discern a light, but there's nothing to be done. The night's depths are opaque, filled with pain, endless. There's no relief that way. Then I see him. The fat, sweaty man who has just come into the room is waving his phone at me. He is taking a photo. He means to immortalize this moment. So horror does have a face, and it's not mine, but his. I am enraged. I want to throw myself at him, tear his paunch open, rip out his guts, and nail his damn phone to his hand so he can take the sweetest selfie of his life while taking his leave of it. But I can't. I can only mumble at him to stop and awkwardly try to hide my face. I am broken, shattered. The old lady understands. She pushes him outside and locks the door. People, she says. You know how they are. The rest of the night goes on like that, with her. I am stitched, washed, cut, stitched again. I lose my sense of time. It runs on. We're floating together on a dark ocean infused with alcohol, carried by a swell that builds and falls away. Around midday the next day, they come to collect me. The helicopter is here. I'm to be transferred to Petropavlovsk. A Russian done up as a firefighter steps out, tall, smiling, crimson-uniformed and reassuring. He offers me a wheelchair. I refuse, stand, hold onto his shoulder to go down the steps. White gray, through the door, and we're on the concrete forecourt. Here, people swarming to see the show are at the ready with their phones. With my free hand, I hide my face again, avoid the flashes, and supported by my rescuer, vanish once again into the belly of the helicopter. I spend the flight semi-conscious. I remember being cold and struggling to breathe, my throat full of blood. When we land, the doctors make me lie on a stretcher on my back. I tell them I can't. I can't breathe like that, but they persist. Several of them come to hold me down. It's as though the entire staff is there, and I am choking. There are shouts, screams, I feel a needle prick in an arm I can't move. Then suddenly everything stops. The lights dance. I lose consciousness for the first time since the bear. Nothing more. Nothing at all. Space. A blank. No dreams. When I wake, I am completely naked, alone, strapped to the bed. Restraints grip my wrists and ankles. I examine the situation. I am in a vast and decrepit white room. Empty beds are lined up beside mine. It looks like one of those old clinics from Soviet times. Voices echo faintly. A tube runs into my nose and down my throat. It takes me a long while to realize why I am breathing so strangely, and that it's this green and white plastic thing stuck to my neck. A tracheotomy. In my mild delirium, I expect to see Dr. Zhivago pop up at any moment. The film set is ready. But it's a blonde nurse who comes in, smiling. Nastinka, you'll come through this, she says. Behind her, a tall, stocky man appears, his boots resounding on the floor tiles, gold chain, gold teeth, gold watch. He's the head doctor, and it shows. It's he who's in charge of future and current operations, who is behind my straitjacket and everything else. Get in his good books, my first thought. He is friendly enough, with his gilded Lord of the Hospital smile. He compliments me. No one understands how it's possible you're alive, but you are. Bravo, molodets. You're a very strong woman, he adds. I reply that I'd just like my straps to come off. We can't do that. It's not possible. You stay this way. It's to protect you from yourself. Oh, right. The 2 days that follow are torture. The tube in my throat is appallingly painful, and the smiley first nurse has disappeared. Another one, younger, looks after me. Too young. The head nurse keeps a vague eye on her. They do have to learn. This novice becomes my worst nightmare. I'm obsessed. All I can think about is how to get free of this prison of straps. As soon as my guardians disappear through the door, I start dreaming up impossible stratagems. Twice I succeed in releasing myself. I pull out the tube, which conveys brown and black mash to my stomach. I remember that color. Time for the feed, I hear, shouted along the corridors at the end of the day. Have you done the feed? The head nurse asks her apprentice. The word is feed. Kormit. I can see my old friend Ila in his yurt in Manas, calling his nephew Nikita. Have you fed the dogs? Go feed the dogs. Eat the kormit. Ever since, I cannot hear that word without a spasm from deep in my stomach. I clearly remember the spiteful black eyes of that girl, scarcely more than a child, her malevolent stare. I can still see her injecting the food down my tube with a single plunge, wanting to punish me, to take revenge for my existence, for her own miserable life, I don't know, for everything that will not obey, everything that stands up to her. She makes it clear that for this once, she has the power. Poured suddenly, brutally onto my stomach, the mash makes me scream with pain. Tears stream down my cheeks. I have never been so powerless, at the mercy of men, women, and even kids. Stripped, strapped down, stuffed. I am at the frontier of humanity, at what feels like the very edge of what a person can stand. Alerted by my cries, the head nurse returns, comes over and scolds her junior, who flashes me a murderous look. It seems they'll all make me pay dearly for my survival in woman versus bear. Does it hurt? Asks the nurse. Yes, I say with all the conviction I can muster, in the hope she will give me something, anything, a drug to attenuate my pain a little. Chin up. Potieria, she says, and goes back to her paperwork. Potieria, too. I can no longer stand to hear. After the episode with the mash, I decide to lay down my arms, or to surrender, for I have no choice. I focus on being as good as gold, not protesting, asking for nothing and expecting nothing, tolerating the pain, the tube, and all the rest, until it's done with, or rather until something is done. If it weren't for the music that echoes around the room, so that every 3 seconds there's a drum roll followed by a single short beat, symphonic wallpaper, I'd have had an easier time concentrating on the circumstances of my subjugation. On inquiring about the nature of this repetitive symphony, I learned that a very old but highly respected scientific study showed that this requiem, played on a loop, helped patients not forget to breathe. Roll, clang, roll, clang. And we breathe, of course. At the heart of the Russian healthcare system am I, an idiosyncrasy of Russia's Far East, still mired in antique habits? I doubt that intensive care patients at Moscow hospitals are listening to the same tune as me. On the other hand, they aren't lying here in this clinic with its gulag styling. I reflect that no one will believe me when I tell them about this when I get out. If I get out. I decide to write it all as soon as I can. Fortunately, my nights are more entertaining, though no less surreal. Anya follows Inna, then Yulia takes the baton. Every evening is the same. The nurse keeping watch sits at a low school child's desk at the end of the room. In the semi-darkness, a minuscule nightlight illuminating her work, she makes compresses. She cuts and folds. Nothing here can be taken for granted. Everything is made by women's hands. Every night, around the same time, the watching nurse's name rings from the next room. A man is calling. Anya. Casually, she stands, glances at my bed, then steps through the door. I needn't listen for long to understand what's afoot. Barely stifled moans reach me, and masculine grunts. The head doctor is getting lively with his nursing staff. It's the same game every night, only the name changes. Yulia, Inna, it follows. The first time I saw the head doctor kiss one of my nurses on the lips in the middle of the day, albeit there was plainly no one but me in the intensive care unit to stand witness, I naively thought she must be his partner. A doctor and a nurse, why not, after all? Realizing that every nurse was kissing the head doctor on the lips as a matter of course, I then decided it must be a local custom. Ivans from the same family will kiss each other on the lips in greeting. But when the moaning was repeated night after night, the world I'd dreamed up took a hit. It must have something to do with some other undocumented custom. What a racket. And along with these sexual realizations, my own human life came to the fore again, and I surfaced from my limbo. How strange to regain one's sense of self by listening to others make love every night. My suffering began to diminish. Satisfied by my docility over the last few days, the nurses free my limbs at last. You won't pull out the tubes? No, I won't pull anything out. I shall merely touch my bare body to remember how it feels. That day, I celebrate another triumph, too. The nurse agrees to turn off the breathing symphony. It is a liberation. Other doctors, male, come to see me, accompanied unfailingly by the head doctor, who, delighted by this good behavior, watches over his survivor like a hawk. We talk, I lying on the bed, pulling my skimpy sheet as high as I can to hide my chest, they at my side or by my feet. Clearly, I am mending. Of course, they still refuse to give me my belongings, especially my phone. That's not allowed in this unit, they claim. I explain that I'm bored stiff. Don't you have anything to give me to pass the time? Anything at all? A book, perhaps? One of the doctors considers, then comes back with a book of jokes about the Russian medical profession, patients, and staff. The cover is black, the text printed large. I don't remember the title. Sorry, this is all I have here. He seems embarrassed. No problem. This is just right, actually. I'll take it, I say. They can't get over it. Nastinka is reading 5 days after waking up, 5 days after her battle with the bear, she's reading. And jokes, too. Word must have got out, for a veritable parade now comes trotting through my room. They come to see me deep in the book. They ask if it's funny. Very, I reply every time. They come to say hello and congratulate me. Towards the end of the next day, the head doctor appears, pushing a small television on wheels. Here you go, he says. Now you can look at something more interesting. The nurse sets it up at the foot of the bed, turns it on randomly, and leaves me alone facing the little screen. Incredulous, I stare at the images that succeed each other without it at first sinking in. It's so bizarre, I can't bring myself to see what I am seeing. The first film I am shown in Petropavlovsk's crumbling intensive care unit tells the story of Nastinka, that is her name in the story, who is looking for her lover in the forest and can't find him. She calls and calls, but how is she to know that, fallen victim to a curse, the man she seeks has been transformed into a bear? She doesn't recognize him when eventually she does reach him. Unable to make her see him, to see who he really is inside, he dies of grief. I go into a daze before this little Red Riding Hood who shares my name, pursued by this bear lover who can no longer speak to her. She, too, unwittingly pursuing this bear, unaware that the man she loves has already metamorphosed. They are condemned to live in different worlds. They can no longer communicate. Their souls, or whatever is inside them, are henceforth imprisoned in skins that are other, that no longer correspond to the same expressions of life. I think of my own story, of my event title Matucha, of the bear's kiss on my face, his teeth closing over me, my jaw cracking, my skull cracking, of the darkness inside his mouth, the moist heat and the pressure of his breath, the grip of his teeth letting go, of my bear who abruptly, inexplicably changes his mind. His teeth will not be the cause of my death. He will not eat me. A tear drops onto my cheek. My refreshed eyes continue to stare at the screen, which does no more now than reflect my own life. I am staring into a mirror. There is no more absurdity, no more strangeness or lucky coincidence. There is only resonance. At this juncture, the nurse comes in, glances my way, sees the tears in my vacant eyes, and turns to the screen. She purses her mouth, annoyed. This is unfortunate, she says. Silence. Shall I turn it off? She turns it off. Because the bear went off with a chunk of my jaw clenched in his own, and because he broke my right zygomatic bone, they will have to operate on me again soon. When I came in, they pinned a plate into the bone to hold up the lower right mandibular ramus. Now, my cheekbone must be reset. Why this wasn't done before is a mystery, But the head doctor assures me this morning that after this I will be able to leave the intensive care unit, to breathe normally. I could even eat by myself, he adds, smiling. For several days now, I have been asking for my things, especially my phone, so I can call my family, without success. But that day, the head doctor's assistant bursts in and marches towards me.
Do you know a shawl?
Hope revives there and then. My words tumble out as I try to explain.
Shawl, my research partner, my friend, my workmate at the social anthropology lab. Shawl, who came too on my first visit to Kamchatka. Shawl, who must be so worried about me by now.
Tell him I am okay. Tell him I'm not dead. Tell him... He cuts me off. Next time he calls, we'll tell him. The next day, the phlegmatic assistant returns.
We have spoken to Shawl.
He says, your mother and brother are on their way. Tears of joy trickle over my swollen, stitched-up face, which must be shining like a setting sun. I have been hoping so hard for them to come. I have called out to them so often, sending my heart's silent words over land and ocean. My poor mother, who worried so much about her daughter always traveling to Lord knows where these past 15 years, to Alaska, to Kamchatka, into the mountains and forests, or under the sea, so often caught up in unstable and perilous situations. My lovely mother, for once, I accede to all her motherly anxiety. Perhaps she wasn't wrong. From my bed in this dilapidated room, I put myself in her shoes, and it's even worse, almost untenable. For the sake of my own survival, I must stop my plunge into her mother's heart, otherwise I'm sunk. I recall clearly something she said just before I went back into the field this year. Words spoken without a smile, with the authority of a mother who knows her daughter is tearing herself in two, being sucked in by that other world that means nothing to her mother, but whose power, influence, and fascination she can feel. A mother whose daughter inevitably defends herself. I'm an anthropologist, she keeps saying. I am not infatuated. I am not losing myself in the field. I'm still me. Everything you tell yourself, because otherwise you'd never go. My mother, then, who said, several months before all of this, if you don't come back this time, I shall be coming to look for you. Knowing that she's somewhere between France, Siberia, and Kamchatka, my heart is bursting with joy and sorrow at once. I think about Niels coming with Mother, my elder brother who plays the protector, my brother who, despite his tall frame, has always been more fragile than I, my colossus with his feet of clay, an unwitting titan of feeling and sensitivity. Lucky Maman is there for him, I think. She will always be the toughest of us three. My mother has come through other wars, and even if no one yet knows for sure, this is one that will end in birth, not death. That night, my last in the intensive care unit, strange screams enliven the darkness. They've picked someone up in the street who was very drunk, unimaginably drunk. Or perhaps he handed himself in, who knows? Anyway, now he is in the room next door. I hear him. I listen. It's a dizzying litany that kicks off then and continues uninterrupted until dawn. The duty nurse has exchanged the head doctor's fat hands for new insults, howling in the corridors and untrammeled obscenities. A door slams. The man next door finds he is locked in and he begins to sing. A long, melancholy song, telling of the good old times. The kolkhoz farms, the Red Army, the cows, milk, reindeer, the books and films, the animal skins and the trading posts, the vodka. I should like to see his face, to see the pain that makes his voice shake between sobs. What is this world?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?